celebrating classics and creating new ones. Only on the Music Vibes Podcast. Now, here's your host, DC Hendrix.
So joining us on the Music Vibes Podcast, brought to you by Orbit Music here in Mishawaka, Indiana. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, everywhere podcasts are available. Be sure to make us one of your favorites by subscribing to keep up to date and leave us a review. Scroll on down and let us know what you are thinking of this podcast where we celebrate classics and create new ones. So our guest for this week, we need a lot of help to talk about all female bands. And we're talking all female rock bands. There's this fantastic article in Rolling Stone. And we got senior writer David Brown joining us right now to help dig into his article and just talk in general, all female-led bands. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Dude, great to be here.
Absolutely. So very excited about this article. So let's start there and just kind of dig into, you know, your approach to writing this article that you have in the Rolling Stone. And you're talking about a band in specific that kind of got everything started. And you were talking about Goldie and the Gingerbread. So talk about your article.
Sure. You know, I think it was somehow, to some degree, instigated by the idea that the Go-Go's are getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, which is great and about time. And, you know, the news of that, as well as the documentary on them last year, which was good, made me start thinking, well, they're great. They deserve to be in there. But kind of as with Rush getting in before Yes into the Hall of Fame, it makes you think, were there people who were doing it before that as well who should be acknowledged? And certainly you had the Runaways in the 70s, and there was a group called Fanny in the late 60s, early 70s. These were also all women bands. And somewhere in the recesses of my brain, I can't remember how it happened, but I was like, oh, wait, wasn't there this band in the really early 60s with Genya Ravon, who went on to do many other things as a solo artist and producer? And I was like, oh, right, is it Goldie and the Gingerbreads, I think? And I just, I just started poking around and realized that there was a kind of a story there that had rarely been told. And with the Go-Go's, like I said, getting into the Hall of Fame, I thought, well, this might be a good time to acknowledge the people who kind of paved the way for bands like the Go-Go's.
Yeah, and that's a big reason why you had that article on, and you highlighted Goldie and the Gingerbread. So I definitely want to start there, as this article really intrigued me, and the story really intrigued me, mainly because I'm a program director for an R&B radio station, and I'm kind of reading this article and this story, and I'm starting to listen to them because personally, I'm a young guy, and I'm still learning, and that's what this podcast is all really about, is not only, you know, getting introduced to new bands, but also learning about these bands that, you know, we may or may not know about. That was before our time. And Goldie and the Gingerbreads was a little bit before my time. Not to mention, you know, as you mentioned in the story, didn't make it into the mainstream, you know, like the big time, into the limelight, like a lot of people would see. And, you know, you talked about, and, you know, when you listen to them, you think, man, this group could possibly be in Motown. You know, you're listening to them like, this could easily be a Berry Gordy group. And that's something I wanted to highlight as well. But you also mentioned in the story how their story, how they got brought up personally, was similar to Jimi Hendrix. Kind of elaborate on that.
Sure. I mean, first, to take it back, you have to realize, of course, that in 1962-ish or 63, when this group first started coming together, the idea of an entire rock and roll band made of women musicians was, like, it's unthinkable back then. I mean, these days it's no big deal. There's been plenty, and you know, we all saw the Linda Lindas, you know, doing popping up on the TV and YouTube and variety shows just recently, and everyone's like, great, cool. But back 60 years ago, which is mind-boggling in and of itself, it was that long ago. The idea of just a band made of women was something that just baffled the industry.
Dream.
And this group in particular came together basically in New York City, started by a woman named Genya Ravon, who I mentioned earlier, who was singing with another band of mostly men, and she saw a woman drummer playing at a club in the Village, and it all kind of clicked, like, well, wait a minute, maybe wouldn't it be cool to have an all-woman band? And they put together several different lineups. As you said, they loved playing R&B covers. They didn't really write that many songs themselves, or hardly any, actually, but they loved playing. They were kind of a cover band early on. And once they kind of solidified their quartet lineup in 63-64, they started touring, and they opened. I mean, you know, you think about it, they landed a record contract with Atlantic Records, which was a big deal. They opened on a European tour for the Stones, and then another tour they opened for the Kinks and the Yardbirds on kind of a package tour. So they had all of these opportunities, and yet, through a number of circumstances, they never quite made it. You know, they put out three singles, none of them were hits, and as a result, they were never accorded an album. You know, which is, you know, back then it's like, well, if your singles don't do well, then you don't get an album. And so there's no, until now, which is there's a compilation album finally coming out all these years later, but there was no album back then. They were not treated shabbily necessarily, but by club owners, but there was a lot of skepticism, like a lot of, you know, and I'm quoting one of the women in the article. She, you know, they would hear things like, use broads, know how to play? What? What is this? You know, they had to kind of really prove themselves that they could play their instruments and sing. And even when they did, you know, they were forced to record songs they necessarily didn't love because it was such a male-dominated industry and so forth. And so, you know, and they continued for a couple of years until finally, you know, just the... you know, the lack of success and, you know, the typical, you know, frictions that come up within bands kind of tore them apart, and they were kind of over by 67 or so and didn't leave much of a trace. You know, there were just a couple singles which are long gone, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, you could find them on YouTube, but that's it. And so, you know, and they had to deal with one particular producer who tried to assault one of the women, and you know, they faced a lot of hurdles back then that a lot of male bands, all male bands at the time, didn't necessarily face. And so it was, you know, they kind of, not to say that, you know, the Go-Go's and others didn't have similar challenges, because they did, but I think this was the first band to really realize, like, you know, we have to really prove ourselves even more and have to overcome these stereotypes even more than... perceived at the time.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, with them coming up in the early 60s, it's in a time where, and you know, as you mentioned in the article and in the story, you know, this is an all white female band who sounds like they could be in Motown, sounds like an all black group. It could very well have been, you could obviously play them, and somebody my age could be like, is that the Supremes? Like it could like they could easily be confused. And just coming up in that time where, I mean, black stations aren't going to play them and white stations aren't going to play them. That's just not, I think it was just the timing was all wrong. They were so ahead of their time and so innovative that it was just, it sucks to say that, but just way ahead of their time, way ahead of it. And as I was reading that story, I just thought, and that's what really inspired this topic today. And, you know, so my first initial reaction to, you know, kind of reading this story as they kind of didn't really make it. Back in the 60s, and it just didn't, the success just didn't sustain itself. So who do you think was the first successful all-women band?
Well, I guess it depends how you define successful. There were gradations of success, mm-hmm. I think. Each band that came along after them broke down another barrier or smashed a little more of that glass ceiling, if you want to say, to get to that point. After Goldie and the Gingerbreads, you had a group, for example, like Ace of Cups, who were a San Francisco-based kind of jam band.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a a little bit more kind of industry attention in the sense of being part of that sort of Grateful Dead scene, and they played, you know, they opened for the Dead and Steve Miller, and again, never even got a meeting with a record company because it was considered so out there. Like, people just, again, we're talking 67, 68. Even then, you know, a few years after Goldie, the idea of an all-woman band was something record company people couldn't get their heads around. They thought it was a novelty. Then you had Fanny, who were an all-woman band who were in the West Coast. They had success in the sense that they actually got a record deal with Warner Brothers Records. They put out four albums on Warner Brothers in the late 60s to the early 70s. Were produced by a guy named Richard Perry, who also produced big hits by Carly Simon and Ringo Starr and many others, and was in the first group with the Genya of Goldie and Gingerbreads before Goldie, but that's a whole other story. But so Fanny took another step. They got the record deal. They got the attention to some degree, but again, the records didn't sell incredibly well, and they broke up as well. Then you had the Runaways. That was Joan Jett, Lita Ford, Sherry Carey, all those women, who they had a major label deal. They had a big producer, Kim Fowley, working with them. They got a lot of media attention. Cherry Bomb is like a total classic of the kind of a glam power pop metal, whatever you want to call it, a classic song. But didn't sell a whole lot of records, and didn't, you know, they were sort of marketed as, you know, they weren't underage, but almost as if there was a weird kind of marketing thing around them that sort of seemed to hamper them as well. But again, they took another step. They got more press than a lot of the bands before, and they made a couple records for a major label. And what you needed at that point was a group to actually have hits. And that's where the Go-Go's come in. But that first record came out, was huge, and, you know, they played all those instruments. They wrote or co-wrote those songs. And so the history of women bands is one little breakthrough after another over the course of, you know, at least 20 years, you know, which certainly was not the case with male bands. There was no learning curve like that, you know. But it shows you what sort of obstacles they face to have to prove themselves. That was just all out of balance.
Yeah, that's crazy. And obviously here in 2021, it's obviously, you know, and that's how far we've come. You know, people listening to this are probably just baffled at how far things have come. You know, while we still got a ways to go when it comes to the ladies getting the love in the Rock Hall, but I think this year's class definitely showed that we're definitely going in the step in the right direction. The Go-Go's, Tina Turner, it's definitely going towards that level. And I'm really glad you mentioned the Runaways and the Go-Go's in that statement, because those are the two all-female groups that I think of right away, and I think most people would. And you mentioned, and so let's talk about the Go-Go's just briefly here. As you mentioned, getting inducted into the Rock Hall, I mean, obviously, a lot of people would agree, you know, well-deserved. I mean, tons of hits, recognizable hits for people even my age. Vacation is probably one that a lot of people would recognize. We Got the Beat, Our Lips Are Sealed. But of course, you know, your first reaction when you see that the Go-Go's finally get that induction into the Rock Hall.
My first reaction was, well, it's a, you know, it's about time.
Right.
Because I think, like you said, those songs, Turn to You is another great one from one of their later records. And again, I think without naming names, I mean, there are some people in the Hall of Fame who maybe just had one hit that was one iconic song, were men. And there are a number of instances like that where you think, well, okay, you know, sure, but what about this other group that has had a whole bunch of hits, and it was 40 years ago, which is long past, you know, the qualification period. You know, why it took this long, I can't explain that. You know, it's just the whole process of it, which I'm not involved in. But I think my first reaction was, well, good. You know, maybe this will, maybe the Runaways will be next. You know, almost like they, I feel like they should be. And, you know, I think it's... I think it's a, you know, it does make me wonder, again, if it took things, and I'm, this is just speculation on my part, but, you know, a couple of years ago there was a Broadway musical based on, with using Go-Go's music. It wasn't a big hit, but it was around for a few months there, pre-pandemic. There was a documentary on the Go-Go's last year, and it's like, okay, I guess... people needed to be reminded by way of these other projects. Oh, yes, right. Right. They were around. Let's consider them. The fact that it maybe took all that to remind people of them was is unfortunate. You know, I mean, it worked out well. But maybe think, well, you know, maybe other groups didn't have to or they, you know, people didn't have to be, have a kind of in-your-face reminders of someone, the way that the first all-woman band in the Hall of Fame had to be reminded of. So it's you know, I think it's a good thing, and I think you know, I think I hopefully it will pave the way for even more in the years to come. I assume it will. We'll see. You know, kind of who's next. And I don't know if Bikini Kill or something will get in there, but that'd be nice, you know. And I think there's certainly a number of other contenders. Like I said, the Runaways would be cool. You know, I think it's a good, you know, it's overdue, but it's a good thing. I guess.
Absolutely.
How I'd put it.
Absolutely agree. And, you know, kind of looking at some other female groups that I had to do a little bit of research in order to come up with a couple of them, just because some of her, I wanted to verify the band name. So one that definitely came to my head, also I had to take it back a little bit for this one. And basically this is just to get a couple more bands from you too, to kind of give some other female groups some recognition here. But I marked down the Ronettes. That's obviously a long time before me, but I do remember Be My Baby. I'm sure that's one that's really, you know, recognizable when people hear that song. Probably a lot of people, once again, I think I was talking about this song earlier to someone in the hallway here at the radio station, and someone's like, isn't that the Supremes? I'm like, no, it's the Ronettes. That's not even, and that's the problem, is a lot of these, you know, bands are so long ago that, and they just assume that they're a different group. But I marked the Ronettes. I also marked Babes in Toyland, Courtney Love, had to give them a little love. And then, the group, so I'm a 90s kid, and I remember hearing this band in the late 90s, and they're called the Donnas. And I know they got big in the late 90s. I definitely wanted to give them some extra pub, as I seen in quotes that they were compared as the Ramones meet the Runaways. And that was the way that they were described. So what do you think of those bands as well as all female groups? And do you have any more to add?
Well, I think, well, it's an interesting distinction. I'm glad you brought it up, between, I guess, what is called in the industry girl groups and actual bands. And I think the girl groups, which is basically the singing groups, who are backed by often male musicians, like the Ronettes, Supremes, other ones like that, they tend to get more respect than the groups that are actually made up of women playing instruments. And so you know, I think that, you know, like the Supremes and Ronettes, and I've been in the Hall of Fame now, I think both for a while, and rightly so, but I think I could, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Destiny's Child at some point got in pretty soon. But it's the groups of women who play their own instruments and things like that that's still the barrier. And I think, well, like you say, Courtney Love should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame, and especially for her band Hole. Babes in Toyland was another band around that time. They didn't quite make it as big as Hole did, but Hole should absolutely, and Courtney is like one of the great rock stars, I think, of the last 30 years. And so it absolutely should be in there. And the Donnas, I think they made some cool records, and I think they built on what was happening, you know, the indie rock world of the 80s and 90s, I think, like, was very important in this, in that there were a lot more women in bands. You had, you know, a woman like a musician like Kim Gordon in Sonic Youth. Like, she was the only woman in that band, but she was one of the front people in the band. She played bass, had a very distinctive style of playing bass and singing. And, you know, she made a statement just being in that band. And I think there were many others who came afterwards, you know, which led to, you know, Courtney Love and Bikini Kill and Babes in Toyland and a whole kind of explosion. A band called Lush, who I think were not entirely, and I think there was maybe a male drummer, if I'm remembering correctly. They were British in the 90s. There was Liz Phair, not a band, but certainly, you know, a front woman. And I think, again, those bands built on kind of what happened with the Go-Go's and the Runaways and took it to another step, another degree, although, again, it took another 10, 15 years.
Right.
You know, there are these long, weird gaps, in a way, between, breakthroughs, and then the next breakthrough is a long time later, unfortunately. It seems to be part of, kind of built into that history. Even now with all this attention on the Linda's, we're in 2021, and I'm thinking, well, okay, you know, when was the last big noteworthy new all-woman band? It was probably at least 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So, you know, it kind of comes in fits and starts, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. We're certainly in a period of time now where, you know, rock has kind of receded. So I think that's part of it. You know, we're in where hip hop and dance music and pop are kind of the leading music of the time, which is fine and all good, but then rock and roll has sort of become a bit more of a niche thing, perhaps, and maybe that is now playing into it somewhat more, but we'll see where it goes from here, and maybe, you know, like all the attention that Linda Lindsay got was, like, kind of amazing. It was like people were, and they were doing a Bikini Kill song, so, I mean, you know, that might introduce the idea of this to a whole new generation, like my 18-year-old daughter, who, you know, is not used to seeing, you know, didn't really grow up with rock, you know, and to kind of just sort of discovering it in some ways, but, you know, she kind of grew up with pop and hip-hop and things like that. And so it's kind of a new idea for her. And so I think that's, again, a good, we're back to baby steps, I guess, in some way.
Good way to look at it. And of course, you know, as you mentioned, I know you mentioned Sonic Youth, and I know we definitely got to talk about your books as well before I let you go. But just one more thing about your story here. And I know you tracked them down, Goldie and the Gingerbreads, to kind of revisit this story, which kind of sparked our entire conversation here, just having me think about, you know, all female led groups and bands. And you got to actually talk to them about, you know, their career and things. So how exactly did they approach, you know, the whole interview process and kind of revisiting the golden days?
They were thrilled to do it. You know, they don't get asked very much about those days. So, and they've all kind of gone off into different things. Only some of them make music anymore. And I think they look back on that with certainly a certain amount of pride and a certain disappointment. I think the Go-Go's getting in before them. makes them think, well, that's great, but gee, what about us? There was a kind of a bit of a recurring sadness about that. But they were all, you know, one of them has passed away, but there are three surviving members of the band. Also, just as a total side note, since I'm mentioning the number of people in the band, you know, they were a quartet without a bass player. So they were doing that whole guitar, organ, drums, lead singer thing before the Doors, you know. Their Margo Lewis, their excellent keyboard player, played bass on bass pedals, the bass notes on the pedals, kind of like Ray Manzarek did in the Doors. So they were even doing the Doors thing before the Doors. And, you know, it's funny to hear them talk about, you know, their one big shot at a hit was a song called Can't You Hear My Heartbeat, which older listeners will know as a big hit in the mid-60s from Herman's Hermits, this British invasion band who did Mrs. Brown, You Have a Lovely Daughter, and things like that. And Gold Digger Gingerbread's recorded it first.
Wow.
And it's interesting, they have such mixed feelings about it, because first of all, to get back to something we were talking about earlier, unlike, say, a lot of you know, the Go-Go's, for example, or Hole and Courtney Love and many others, they didn't totally have control over what songs they would get to record. And they didn't like that song. They grew up on R&B. Their act included, they would do covers of songs by the Supremes and Sam and Dave and Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood. That's the music they loved and would perform. But they get in the studio and their producer's like, do this kind of, you know, lily white cutesy pop song. And they didn't like it, but they didn't have a choice. It was like, here's what you got to record, which was a sign too of how little control women had at that time in the mid '60s. So they did it, and they're thinking, okay, we're not crazy about it, but you know, we'll play the game. And sure enough, the Herman's Hermits version comes out first in America, and basically beats them to it, and they're kind of left in the dust. So like their one little moment, which they weren't crazy about to begin with, really turns out to be a misstep. But again, so revealing of how, you know, what little control women had. They didn't produce it themselves. They didn't pick the song. They you know, had a few extra musicians play with them. You know, it was, again, a sign of how the industry couldn't kind of grapple with the idea. It was so foreign that people were just kind of scratching their heads. Like, what do you do with a group of just women playing? We let them play their own instruments? Do we let them pick their own song? Gee, I don't know. You know,
it's crazy.
It was a crazy time.
It's crazy. Crazy. But good stuff here, David. I mean, a fantastic story that you've written here that's been on my mind since you released it. And as always, I mean, you guys are always doing great stuff at Rolling Stone. My good buddy Brian Hyatt has been on this podcast a few times. And obviously, you guys do fantastic work at rollingstone.com as well. So I cannot bring you on without promoting your books as well. You mentioned Sonic Youth earlier, and I know you have a biography on them, but go ahead and, David, before I let you go, definitely promote some of your books to the listeners, please.
Well, we authors always appreciate it. Thank you. Yes, I've written biographies of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and The Grateful Dead and Sonic Youth, and a book called Fire and Rain, which was about the year 1970 in the music and the country and the culture. And I also did a biography of the late Jeff Buckley and his father, Tim. And I'm currently working on a book about the history of music in New York's Greenwich Village, tracking it from over the decades of its kind of rise and heyday and fall, which was a fascinating scene that was also much more diverse than we remember. It's not just all the Inside Llewyn Davis kind of stuff. There was a lot going on there, and a lot of struggles and suppression going on there as well. So I'm in the middle of that, and that won't be out for a little while, but I'm excited about that book as well. You go to www.davidbrownsande.com for more information, as they say.
I love it. That was a good commercial. Great stuff. Great stuff. I might have to get you to write some of my commercials for me. That was good.
Try this product.
If you're listening right now, go ahead and scroll on down in the description, and all the links are right there. I got a couple of links to a couple of the books in case you want to check them out, and also the article that pretty much, you know, sparked our entire conversation today, talking all women bands or groups. David Brown from Rolling Stone joining us today. David, thank you so much for joining. We'll have to do this again. Great stuff.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here. Really appreciate it.
It's now time to Drop the Needle, brought to you by Orbit Music here in Mishawaka, Indiana. Record store, DVD, and video store located at 2538 Miracle Lane right here in Mishawaka, Indiana. Go ahead and see my friends. See Doug and tell him that Music Vibes Podcast sent you. Get you a record or two, a DVD or two, a CD or two. They got it all for you located at Orbit Music here in Mishawaka. So it's time to Drop the Needle. We talked all female bands. My personal favorite one that I think is one of the most underrated, and it probably helps that they came up during my teenage years, my growing up, so I may be a little bit biased. That's okay. But I'm going to drop the needle today on the Donnas. This is from their album Spin the Night, released in 2002. So let's drop the needle right now on the Donnas. Here's Take It Off. Let's drop the needle.
Time Travel with DC Hendrix on the Music Vibes Podcast. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify on your mobile device.